You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It felt like the entire country was watching in October 1991 as Anita Hill appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee to testify that she had endured repeated acts of sexual harassment when she'd worked with Clarence Thomas. Mr. Thomas denied the claims and was appointed to the Supreme Court, but despite that, the hearings had a far-reaching impact. Anita Hill's testimony had brought sexual harassment in the workplace to the forefront of the cultural conversation. Now, nearly 23 years later, she's the subject of a new documentary called Anita Speaking Truth to Power. It was directed by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Frieda Mock, and I'm very pleased to welcome Anita Hill back to our show and Frieda Mock for the first time. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having us and me.
And I'm very, very happy to be here.
Now, Anita, you'd already written a book about this time, with the same title. Why did you decide to participate in Frieda's documentary, considering the fact that you say a lot of people had approached you over the years about doing something?
Well, I realize the significance and importance of the visuals in this hearing, and we see that sometimes in the still photos. But when Frieda approached me and I realized that we had a chance to actually put this together in a way that told a story in a visual way for an entire new generation of people who didn't really even know about the hearings, that the time was now.
Now, I'm assuming you rewatched the footage of the hearings before you participated in the film. Was that a painful experience?
Watching the footage, it is a painful experience. But with the 22 years of hindsight and perspective and really having a chance to talk with people about what they meant to them, what the hearings meant to them, I think I have a perspective now that allows me to put those hearings in the proper place.
Frieda, what do you remember most vividly about the hearings before you started working on the film?
Well, I vividly remember how I believe I was actually jogging, and I heard Senator Hatch sort of vilifying this person. You know, I didn't even have to see her in my mind's eye. And I was just stunned by the how vicious the commentary was. It's so vivid to me to this day. The kind of venomous kind of way he spoke about Anita Hill. So that was very vivid, just audibly. And then just watching it over the weekend, I just was astonished, particularly at the comments made by many male witnesses on the side of nominee Clarence Thomas. These were self-serving comments, and I was just amazed that the senators would allow this kind of self-serving commentary, in which was actually very critical of Anita Hill. So it was just that kind of dynamics of the men kind of, you know, I would say, ganging up on this one witness.
Well, one of the most striking aspects of the hearings is the visual of the 14 white men and the Senate Judiciary Committee sitting across from Anita, a young black woman, questioning not just her testimony, but her character.
And I think that's a visual.
You must have been aware of that at the time.
Well, I think what I was aware of was that I was there for a purpose, which was to tell what had happened to me when I worked for Clarence Thomas. So much of it, I just couldn't absorb. I felt the sense of power that they had to control that setting. But I don't think I fully absorbed it all until much later. And the visual was so... people talk about that blue or aqua dress. And I think that one of the reasons that they remember it is that it was in clear, stark contrast. Here I was sitting there, this, as you say, African young... much younger African-American woman in a blue dress. And there they
were all younger
then. All, yes. And they were all out there with their gray suits. I was sitting there alone at the table, and they were surrounded by this bevy of clerks and assistants and people who were sort of their backup and support. And I think that's amazing that so many people identified with me in that setting.
And you point out in the film that there was a run on blue dresses that was similar to the one that you were wearing. But how did, had you come to be there in the first place? Had you offered to testify?
I came to be there because the Senate staffers approached me. They came to me a couple of times, and the final time they came to me before I really talked to and answered their question, they had very specific information that related to me about my experience. And that is when I gave them a statement. I ultimately then spoke with the FBI. But I also, in addition to the FBI statement, I wanted to be able to write my own statement in my own words about what my experience was. And so ultimately that statement was leaked, and then I was subpoenaed to testify.
Now, other women who weren't allowed to testify have confirmed what you said. They said that they'd had similar experiences, or they remember you telling them about what was going on with you. Why do you think they weren't called?
Well, let me tell you. Let me just clarify two things. One, they were able and willing to testify. They came forward on their own. These were not women that I knew, but they had similar, separate experiences to mine. And so there was clear evidence of a pattern of behavior. And secondly, their testimony was never given publicly, so they were allowed to enter it into the record. But as we all know, it was having that person sitting in the seat, talking about it, telling people what it meant, how painful it was for them, that has been so powerful and effective. So the written testimony in the record, I don't think most people even know that it exists.
Frida, millions
of...
That
the three women were, in fact, were subpoenaed, and they were sitting there that October Columbus Day weekend for 3 days waiting for the chair, Joe Biden, to call them. So that was interesting that not only were they willing, as Professor Hill says, but that they were legally, you know, mandated to be there.
And you have all of the footage, which some of which comes across as rather damning. Anita mentioned Orrin Hatch. But also Alan Simpson accused you of being inconsistent and kind of like a fallen woman. And Arlen Specter wasn't all that kind. Have any of them, Joe Biden or any of the others, talked to you about this afterward?
No, not at all.
Nobody's apologized to you?
And, you know, in the sort of vaguest terms, Alan Simpson sort of made an overture and said, I think we should be able to work together on some issues. And I don't know where he came up with the idea that was a point of reference for us to come together. But as I say, I think for the senators, it was about politics. And for me, it was about my life. And they never bridged that gap. But your use of the term fallen woman is a very polite way. They were much more impolite in 1991, which is probably why we've never come together.
My guests are Anita Hill and Frida Mock. We're talking about a new documentary called Anita Speaking Truth to Power, directed by Frida Mock. It opens tomorrow, actually, at the Angelica Film Center, at the film, and at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. Frida, millions of Americans watch the hearings on television, and the media coverage is a major part of the story. What did you do you think of how the media represented Anita and the hearings in 1991?
Well, I think with C-SPAN and CNN, you had kind of archival actual, the events were presented as they in time. In fact, I had a recent experience at a festival where an attendee, a gentleman, said, I'm a Republican, a very successful business person, and I believed she was lying in 1991. I don't believe it now. And he said that, I felt blindsided, essentially, by the news reports, that he felt that there was a spin that the news media took on, and the American public just believed almost like a press release that was written by the the Republicans. So,
can I just talk about that a little bit? Because I think what happened was the Washington Press Corps covered it, and they tried to cover it as a political scandal. You know, that was the script that they had from the Republicans. But a few weeks and months later, we had a number of women journalists who sort of shifted it and said, you know, this is a problem in the workplace. They knew it personally. And then they went out and they started talking to women about why this was not just some kind of political ploy, but why this was a problem, a social problem that extended well beyond the politics.
Well, the press sort of dealt with it as a he said, she said. Which is the way we still deal with an awful lot of big political issues.
Well, let me go back to one thing about that he said, she said. The way the Senate conducted the process by eliminating those three women who had similar experiences, what they did was to construct it as a he said, she said, when in fact it was me and a number of other women who had witnessed it firsthand, so that it really, in reality, was never a he said, she said.
There was also a suggestion that sexual harassment was not a major issue in America.
Oh, they absolutely said, oh, what she's describing never happens. And I think in so many ways that's why the public responded and said, if these guys don't get this, what else are they missing? You know, they don't understand our lives.
Well, how far have we come? Because Brigadier General Jeffrey A. Sinclair has been in the news recently with a sexual harassment case. And in the end, he has pleaded guilty to some other things, adultery, but the sexual harassment has been pretty much dismissed.
This is why process matters, because what we witnessed...
You're speaking like a lawyer
yes,
now.
I know. I can't help it.
It's okay.
You know,
but
I think it really does point out and connect that with what happened in 1991. The process mattered. Having a fair process will let you get to the truth and sort these things out. Having a fair process and a clear process in the Sinclair matter, I believe, would have led us to the truth. And then ultimately, we would have had to determine what the consequences for the behavior should be. So I think if people can look at this film and say, look, this is how the process failed all of us. But they also need to look at it and say, how are our processes today helping us get to where we need to be?
Now, Frieda, the film kind of breaks up into three separate segments. The first is the testimony. The second is what happens after the testimony and how Anita's life is totally disrupted, and she receives death threats, but also some support. And then the third part is pretty much about sexual harassment and how this opened up the discussion. It was there before, but this really did open it up on a much broader level.
Yes, I think it took that national sensational hearing to alert the Americans to the fact that there are laws and that you can do something about this and that there are protections. But I think because of the hearings, you soon had these mandated policies, certainly in corporations and companies, where employees and managers, you know, must understand and take classes on sexual harassment. And I think people began to understand that they do have, how to, in fact, protect their rights, and that there are mechanisms to file complaints. And we saw an increase in the filing of sexual harassment cases with the EEOC. And what's really encouraging for all of us 20-something years later is that you see in the story, in the film, this next generation of young activists who, like the Girls for Gender Equity and Hollaback, and who are very clear about the issues, are articulate, are able to use social media, and are very strategic in trying to get to the next level of understanding your rights and protecting them.
Now, after the hearings, as I mentioned, you received death threats. There were all sorts of other problems that you dealt with, and of course you had been tarred and feathered by the whole process. On the other hand, I suspect that there were women coming to you and telling you, I had similar experiences, and that's kind of how the thing wound up evolving.
That absolutely is essential to where I am today. The fact that so many women stepped up and said, you are not alone in this. This happened to me. I did what you did. I did something different. This, you know, the results were the same, or the results were, all of that has helped me to understand. And it's really enabled me to take on the issues that I didn't even know that I was raising at the time of the testimony. It wasn't my intent to say, okay, let's have a public conversation, but it was that public conversation that ultimately pushed us forward.
Do you think that your testimony removed some of the stigma surrounding talking about sexual harassment?
It absolutely did. I have so many people who have told me, I shared my experiences with my loved ones, whether it was a spouse or a daughter or a mother. I shared those experiences for the first time in my life. And those kinds of conversations really is what gets people to understand that this is a problem, and it's a problem that is either affecting them or someone whom they love.
Now, you were a law professor at the University of Oklahoma at the time. What was the reaction of your students?
I had a great deal of support from many of my students. We all felt as though we were under siege by the press and some of the things that were coming out. There were some students, not students in my classes, but at the university, who actually the Senate went after and tried to get them to send in statements about me to try to have me fired. But my students at the law school were curious. They wanted to know. They asked questions, and I wanted to help them understand.
They tried to have you fired.
They absolutely did. Yes, they did. I had tenure, notwithstanding my tenure. They wanted to have me fired. Then they said, okay, well, if we can't fire her, let's just close the law school. Instead, state legislators in control of the budget can put a lot of pressure on officials in state institutions, and they did.
Is that why you eventually left and moved on to Brandeis?
I left for a number of reasons. I left
because your roots were in Oklahoma.
And they still are. And I'm very happy about that. I was just in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we had a wonderful screening of the film there. But I left because I knew that if I was going to really take seriously all of those questions that still are lingering, that I needed to be in a place that supported my work. I found that in Brandeis University. But I also am in a place now where I am in conversation with not just lawyers, who are important to this process, and that's very important, but also sociologists and psychologists and people who understand sort of the personal elements of this issue in order for us to truly understand what equality is and how it looks and what we need to do. We need to take a very complex look at these problems and look at in a broader sense than just litigation.
Well, we'd like to believe that we've come a long way, but then I think about some of the things that we've been seeing in the news recently beyond Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair's case. There has been resistance, well, actually a law to make military sexual harassment something that would be judged by more than just superior officers has been voted down. There are many states that are resisting implementing the Lilly Ledbetter law, which would call for equal pay for equal jobs. Are we seeing a kind of a pushback now?
Well, let me say that the law that was under consideration to remove or to try to revamp the process in the military had 55 votes in the Senate. So I think that's significant. We can't just dismiss that as sort of unimportant. So
but you need 60 these days, even though
because
even
of
though
the filibuster.
That's ten votes over the majority.
That's to avoid the filibuster. But 55 is a majority. So a number of senators do believe that what we have to do now is to move the process and change the process. I think that people are not quite fully understanding the relationship between Lilly Ledbetter and equal pay and harassment. There are women today who are suffering harassment and discrimination, but they will not move because they need that paycheck. And if we give women equal pay, it's going to have an enormous effect on our ability to feel empowered, to take jobs that, you know, that pay us what we're worth, and to avoid and be able to come forward when we have problems of discrimination in the workplace. So I just think that we have to take all of those things together, a holistic approach to this.
Now, Frieda, you chose to open the film by playing a voicemail that Anita received from Ginny Thomas, Clarence Thomas's wife, in 2010. She asked her to publicly apologize for the accusations against her husband. Why did you start it off with that?
Well, that phone call, almost on the 20th anniversary, suggested to me, and certainly to Anita, that the issues of the hearings are very resonant today, very, very active and raw, and that allowed just symbolically for the film to say that the story is both about now and then, and to see how we are today, and as well as look at the past. So I felt that it was a great, it was an astonishing call, and but thematically it allowed us to really frame the story in this 20 and to the contemporary as well as the past.
But she also asked me to explain why I came forward in that voicemail. I did not accept the invitation to apologize.
Well, first of all, you say you first thought it was a hoax.
Oh, of course I did. But but once I found out it was her, I will not apologize. But I think what the film does is to explain, because there was so much misinformation, and there really was a need, I think, for people to understand what was happening. And I think that, ironically, even though I wasn't quite sure at the time when I saw the opening, I think, ironically, it opens the question, why this happened and what it means today.
Go ahead, Frieda.
No, that's exactly, she says it perfectly. And
I'm assuming it also casts a kind of a pall over their marriage. They are both very religious. She is a major figure in an evangelical church. So having her husband accused of the kinds of things that you said he did, I think she just has to believe that he was telling the truth. But it is also interesting that the racial aspect of this whole of the hearings worked against you and for him.
Interestingly, and that's one interpretation of it, but the other interpretation was, in fact, because people say gender, you know, lost out to race. Well, the other interpretation is that his gender was what allowed all of the senators to sort of side with, or at least give him a benefit.
I mean, boys will be boys?
Well, you know, being a man, especially in 1991, as you look at those visuals, being a man in 1991 in Washington, D.C., had its privileges. And it had, there were a lot of things that went on that men could do and get away with, and they were just sort of assumed because you were attached to these very powerful people. And remember, he was attached to a very popular, at the time, president. So it is not just that it was my gender, but it was also the fact that he was a man and had enjoyed that privilege for his entire career there.
But he did bring up race. He called it that, a high-tech lynching, although I've never understood what that phrase meant. But I know what lynching means, and he was saying, in effect, that he was being picked on because he was an uppity black man.
And that was somewhat shocking, because he had been a proponent of the idea that race didn't matter. And so then for him to use that metaphor to assume this mantle of being the downtrodden person. He had eschewed people, eschewed people who said, you know, they were victims. And then he was embracing his own victimhood. So there were so many ironies there, but it was really strategic. It was just a strategy. And so now I understand it as that. And I think when people see the film, they will understand it as that too. So I think we can have it now, a better discussion about what race meant in those hearings.
Yeah, well, it was politically strategic and brilliant. And as Professor Ogletree said, you know, they backed off because no one wanted.
Professor Ogletree being one of your supporters from the start, in, as we see in the film. Just one more thing. Do you think you'll ever get past this? Will you ever be able to put it past you and just try to be Anita Hill Professor of Law and whatever else you teach at Brandeis?
Well, you know, it is a part of my history. It's a part of my life. And what I am working on now, as opposed to just getting past it, is to find meaning in it and to make that a positive meaning. You know, it's a part of who I am and a part of my life.
And you become a hero to many people.
And
that has to be gratifying.
It's gratifying to know that I have helped people find their voices and to deal with the pain that they have experienced in the past and to move forward with their lives.
To some degree, Frida, was that your intention here with this film?
Well, actually, I simply was one, I think, of many people watching the hearings, and I was a bit confused. I didn't really feel 20 years later that I actually understood the big picture. And I actually asked myself, what happened to Anita Hill? You know, we knew she was an instant, amazing presence, you know, 20-something years ago. But I didn't, so I was curious, you know, at first about her story. So I felt both the importance of telling her story of a person who had a huge, you know, dramatic historical impact on the working lives of women and men, and that also I wanted to understand, you know, what happened to the issue of sexual harassment and then where have we gone, you know, 20 years later. So that was the idea, was to really understand her story and the issues within this 20-year perspective.
And I will say that's where Frida and I come together. I knew what happened to me, but what I really want us to know now is where are we with issues, especially when we're seeing it on college and university campuses, we're seeing it in the military, we're seeing it in the locker room of the Miami Dolphins, we're seeing all of this in our society. So where are we and what's the next step?
Anita Hill is the subject of a film called Anita Speaking Truth to Power, directed by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Frida Mock, and I'm very pleased to have had both of them as my guests today on our show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.